Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And we're really pleased to have in the studio with us Dr. Tia Kansara, director of Kansara Hackney.
Oh, hello there.
And this is...
I thought you were talking about super producer Matt.
No,
hey, how are you doing?
Not bad.
Yeah, it's good to have you in studio.
This has been years in the making, actually.
Wow.
Because we've been, not so much for the podcast, but we've been connected for a while through like Sandbox and mutual friends. And this is the first time that we're actually meeting in person to be in the studio to record the show.
We have not been connected for years, but here we are. Boom.
And we're all friends.
It's all on point.
I like that.
Awesome. Well, just to lay a little bit of the preamble, tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us a insight in as concise a way as possible, because we have a lot to cover. But I want to let our listeners know exactly who you are, how accomplished you are, and where your focus is. No pressure, but pressure.
Absolutely non-taken.
And what brought you to the Trump team at the end as well?
Oh, my God. So a little bit about myself. I started my economics degree with a kind of a question of what it really means to live a life in terms of the philosophy by which that economics was used. And it really irked me that the economics of the day didn't really apply to what we were doing in real life. And so the theory and the practice just didn't match. And I think in terms of the credit crisis and the financial crisis, what had been a sort of economics degree ended up sort of turning my world upside down. And what I learned from that was that if you really want to live a life of some sort of fulfillment, there has to be this piece of well-being in there. And so lifestyle becomes a very important piece. And where do we want to live when we have a particular lifestyle? In cities, where we're hyper-connected. And so cities became a very interesting space for me to design a lifestyle that I wanted to live and a lifestyle that other people could live as well. And so I connected both of them and designed pretty much a company with an architect. And so where economics and architecture come together is where I pretty much exist.
That's a great place to kind of start and flesh this out. Like, I'm a city kid. I'm born and bred in New York, Brooklyn specifically. Cities.
Yeah,
cities impact everything that I do. And, you know, we joked a little bit about the West Indian thing. I have family in London. I have family in Bath. Like, this idea of sort of connecting to cities is always critical. It seems like we're at an interesting stage in the world development where it's almost, I'm going to speak a little bit maybe to the United States, but I think you see this phenomenon in other major like Western countries where there seems to be a clear dichotomy between those who choose cities and those who live in outskirts, suburbs, smaller towns and villages. Like, can you give us an idea of how that sort of break is impacting your work?
Definitely feel that there are some specific things that I can talk about right now. One is almost the radius within which I want to operate and what I want within that radius. So, for example, do I want countryside? Do I want access to particular amenities? And so the difference between those two sort of suburban or smaller scale towns and villages that people live in and those larger mega city type experiences are the kind of things that I want to do in a city. For me, in particular, I've lived in probably 10 different cities and I've traveled to 72 different countries. And when I literally enter a city, it's as if, just like I would a person, I get a first impression of the city, of the people, of the kind of, almost like the personality of the city. And so you're meeting the energy of the city. And it kind of like allows you to think about and feel the interaction that you would have with the people, with the way that they act, behave, what levels of anxiety there are, what level of pace there is in their life, how much distinction they have to the geographic location, and what connection that they have with particular geographic location. Do they feel that this is home? Do they feel that people are their home? And so there is, it's really for me, this association that people have to the spaces in between the buildings, because that's kind of what makes the city.
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I feel like you mentioned earlier the practice of economics kind of being disconnected from how we actually live our lives, and particularly with regards to our well-being, our emotional lives. And I think that also it comes up a lot in terms of how we view community and sort of all of the kind of, I guess you could call it in economic speak, like externalities, but the reality is all of these things that allow something to be a successful city, like you're talking about. Do you think that one of the challenges that we have to sort of somehow deal with, and I don't necessarily mean by having like alternative measurements or accounting for it, because I think that that's kind of actually the wrong, like it's kind of a quantitative glass on fundamentally qualitative things. But when we talk about things like keeping people in their homes, issues like inequality, issues like building a community in the city, those are the kind of tangible justice versions of some of the kind of quality of life things that you're talking about, like people feeling a sense of community, stability, connection. And if we took those challenges seriously, then our whole kind of measurement of what our successful city is would start to change.
I think in terms of the city as well, not just the design and the plan of it, is the feedback of the city into those that have designed it. So if you were to look at, say, a building as an example, a smaller scale of a city, really, there's the design of the building, the occupation of the building, and then how the occupation of the building relates to the design for what it was built for. So, for example, if I've designed a building to operate in a particular way, but then once people have moved in, it's a complete mismatch between the actual design of the building and what is happening right now. And that gap is where a lot of architects, designers, and multiple stakeholders don't have information, because once people move in, there is sort of no feedback into the system that designed them in the first place. And so you end up with this massive gap. And that gap is what eventually becomes the problem for a lot of designers. So they'll build a building, but it doesn't really relate to the people who live and work in these spaces. And so you'll design a building, but it doesn't have anything to do with the people who want to live there and work there. And in many cases, the kind of money that goes into these buildings and the maintenance of these buildings isn't really catered for within the design of it as well. So you'll design this crazy building, but then learn long term that the maintenance is so much more expensive. But had they have known that, that could have been part of the decision making process. Or even if those people who are going to be using that building were used in the design process, they'd know whether this building was going to be appropriate for them or not. And in the same way, I think it relates to the kind of lifestyle that people want to have in cities too. Cities are evolving. What it was designed for and what people are doing right now is an evolution over time and space.
Will you elaborate on that evolution or evolution, which sounds better?
I think I think what's really at question here is whether the city that is designed and the city that is unplanned, planned or unplanned, which one ends up becoming much more of an appropriate city for the people that are living there. So something that I'd like to draw attention to is Aleppo, a city in Syria, which I visited in 2009, again in 2010, early part of, before the Arab Spring. And I mean, today it's sort of ruined, but I really count my blessings to have been able to walk through the streets of this ancient city. When I first visited, and it was with an architect who had actually planned the city as a UNESCO World Heritage Site in 1984, Adli Kudsi, and the architect had come back to the city after many years of living in the States and realized that there was this beauty in this urban form, but it was being neglected. And the city mayor wanted to put kind of like a motorway directly into the heart of this ancient city, but he wanted to preserve that feeling that the city had been continuously inhabited for over 1,000 years. And I think cities that have become appropriate for the groups of people and however many different changes, wars and other strife, as well as the successes and failures, have continued to be a place of home. So the evolution of the home and the appropriateness of that space to still mean something to those people over time.
You talked about in your statement a little bit before about this idea about feedback And they instantly jumped out at me because I think in a city like New York, you oftentimes feel like whether or not you're talking about a particular building, just in the city as a whole, that forces and things are happening to which there is no feedback. How much of that is by design? You know, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on who you are, the development of cities is a huge business. And oftentimes it doesn't feel like the regular people are being considered in that, you know, and as we've had this long running thesis around making cities not only quote unquote the smart city concept, but a city that's actually workable and livable for regular people. You know, my family are immigrants and I often say sadly that I don't think they could come to this version of New York and accomplished what they did, you know, and so I'm wondering like how much of that is factored in or can be factored in to actually make cities that are have amenities but are also affordable for regular people.
Mm-hmm. There's a few things there. I mean, something that comes to me is what constitutes a citizen of a place? And what is the role of that citizen over, you know, the role of another citizen of another place? The second thing that comes to me is what smart is. You've got this identity of what a smart city is, largely determined by technology, right? Smart phones, smart cities. And that then leads to this idea or the identity of the human inside the city as being smart or unsmart. The intelligence aspect of it and collecting it and then feeding it back into the system in order for, you know, the way that you use your smartphone becoming the data that is then used to determine the decision making going forward. And the other thing that comes to mind is the final piece. How much of the city is accessible to the diversity of the citizenship? So if I take the first one, citizenship, what does a future citizen look like? Who is that person? And what's their responsibility?
Matt, probably.
Matt.
Yeah, I'm thinking Matt.
Matt, are you the citizen. Future citizen?
Yeah. Yeah. Futures.
He's smiling coyly.
That's the best kind of smile
that I know.
No, yeah.
Maybe slyly sometimes.
But anyway.
Citizenship.
Future yeah. Citizenship. So the future of citizenship, I mean, how much involvement is there in citizenship right now? Like, how involved are you in the way that the city is determined for you? How much of the city is designed with what you want in mind? And I think at the moment there is a sort of almost like handing over the process of or handing over the responsibility of the city to those people who are in control or managing the city on behalf of us. But I think equally there is and there are and there can be methods to take in the information from citizens, like citizen science and data science, to collect that information in order for that to factor crowdocratically into the decision making of the city. So long term, I see that we will play a role because we pay for that long term into the actual decisions of how our city is built up and what kind of decisions are made on behalf of us. And I think at the time right now where we feel maybe uncomfortable living in a specific area, we might locally be able to, in a neighborhood, design collectively how we want that city area to appear. And that is culturally appropriate for us too. And I think that's where Japan always comes to me as an example because of something called Rentai Sekinin. Rentai is community and Sekinin is responsibility. Something that has almost been removed from us is the responsibility of what we do in these public spaces. So if I were to draw out spaces between private and public, normally it's just two, private or public, but there's the public, semi-public, private, semi-private. And I'm sure there's many spaces in between. Where in Japan, a community will come together every week and, you know, whether you're the CEO or a housewife, you'll have a broomstick and you'll be cleaning up the local environment, like your block. much of that doesn't really happen in other cities because there is, it's, you've given the decision making to somebody else and you've given the cleaning up or whatever else to a specialized unit. And so these units don't really work together seamlessly because the community has no role to play in it. So where can the community play a role and how can that be determined by the individuals that live there? And it could be that just like in London, most people sort of joke about it, but it's less and less likely that you would know your neighbor. It's less likely that you would knock on the door and know that that's Tom because Tom and you don't interact.
Oh, word. You know Tom.
Tom. Okay. Tom's a great mate of mine.
Yeah. Tom's a good guy. What about the power part of this equation? Because I think that everything you're saying makes a tremendous amount of sense to me. And then I think that some of these challenges that we face, and I could be, you know, specific about New York and even witnessing, like, my family's from New York. They've, you know, went to do like the hippie thing in Massachusetts, which is where I grew up. And then as soon as I could, I got back to New York. And even in the past several years, I can see like the waves within waves of gentrification in this city. I can remember the neighborhoods several years ago where it was like white interlopers who were maybe though at least connected with an industry or doing something that maybe was related to a neighborhood, right? To like the cycle now where it's like they've been pushed out, like the initial gentrifiers have been pushed out. And now you go to a neighborhood like Williamsburg. The joke I make is that like, it isn't even like the cool lawyers that are moving in anymore. You know, like a couple years ago, it was like, well, I practice law, but I read sometimes. And now it's just like, Williamsburg's awesome. And now it's not because they're there all the time, you know, and the clubs are less interesting and there's actually major consequences to creative culture to, where we talk about shout out from the margins, which is like culture gets incubated in spaces that aren't, you know, ironed out and streamlined. They come from the margins to some extent. And then there's also just the reality of like people just being priced out of their homes. So I think it's like, what's the relationship between, you're totally right with the sort of like civic disengagement and that affects people's sense of stakeholdership and relationship to the city. And then there's also certain issues where it's like, there's a lot of citizen engagement and some real estate developer just wants to throw up yet another Duane Reade, which is another New York specific example when there really doesn't need to be. That's what's going to pay the rent. So you even see now, like the last tangential example I'll give is there used to be, we were talking about the West Indians earlier. There used to be on Flatbush, this place called Christie's, which did great, really good patties, right? Really good Caribbean patties, like legitimately, like not the best, but certainly better than anything in that realm that I've gotten outside of Phil's mom's kitchen. Yeah. Which is a whole other Golden thing, right?
Yeah. Like that.
Oh, Golden Crust will make you ill.
Yeah.
Golden Crust deserves to get priced out. We're not even going to go with Golden Crust. No love to Golden Crust. But Christie's was like always popping. It was rated on Zagat and it was there, right? So, and they're out. They're gone. And I don't know, maybe they just made the decision that like, you know, they had put some money aside, they're going to move to a different neighborhood, whatever. But I think that's an example of a place that actually was successful, right? It did have a lot of foot traffic. It was sort of doing something. And even that is priced out of the structure. So is this like the part of the equation where we start talking about like, I don't know, reintroducing rent control, different types of power distribution? Do we say like those community boards and community actions you're talking about need to somehow be invested with real power in the city? I guess where does that element come in terms of dealing with these challenges and exploring the opportunity of the city that you're talking about so well?
I think I love the example of a kibbutz in Israel or a moshav. And these were communities that were co-owned local spaces that were designed by the people for the people and continued to be used by the people and sort of evolved with the identity of whatever that particular kibbutz was. And I think if I look at a city, the identity or the multicultural identity of the city is something that is preserved when it's appreciated. It is preserved when it has the space for it to evolve into something that is, you know, the kind of almost like the tension of the city. It is the ownership structure of the city, the organizational structure of the city. And I think there are areas in, of course, these sort of top tier type cities that are like London and Tokyo and Beijing, where areas become so much more gentrified that they just push all the culture out of them because they become so popular that the rental price just skyrockets and over the course of 5 or 10 years become untenable, you know, just unaffordable to live in. And that then becomes a difficulty for anybody else who wants to go and express themselves. And if you look at San Francisco and a lot of the creative artists moving down to LA being another example in the States.
And also families.
And too, families as well, and yeah. finding it so difficult to pay for all of the, you know, the costs of running a family in the middle of a city. Yes, rental controls, you know, controlling the amount of, you know, percentage increase of the rental price per annum. But I'm in favor of having communities that actually design their own space, own their own space, at least co-owned spaces, collaborative spaces, defined by those people who live there. And I think there should be some element of communal living. I think that's what we're missing here. We've become so individual that we've become segregated from any sort of unity, and that unity isn't even felt. And so the unity is almost absorbed by the larger central committee, and the power is taken from whoever it is that lives there, because they're a unit. They're just a number. Right. They're like a unit in the big mass system of the engine of the city. And so they get sort of utilized in that individuality rather than the communal. And it's like the decentralization of these spaces could allow for communities to have a larger role and are empowered to do something as a collective. And working together to almost save these cultural experiences that make that one area so specific and exciting and culturally specific. You know, like, you know that there is a Indian town over there, or, you know, a little Chinatown over here. And many cities do have Indian town and Chinatowns. But what about Turkish town area or various other cultures?
Oh, I wouldn't want Turkish town area.
Why not?
Just messing with you. I studied in Turkey. I love Turkey. Because I wanted to get that reaction. That was your answer.
That was a plan.
Yeah, that was
beautiful. That was a plan.
Perfect.
Cheeky. I think this idea of connection to people and each other and individuals and kind of that idea of knowing your neighbor, that there has been sort of a disconnection from each other for a long time, whether that's through people want industrialization or late stage capitalism or whatever has kind of driven us to kind of have these wedges between each other, that this idea of the individual kind of rising above all the noise, and if I'm okay, you're okay, as all these sort of breakdown philosophies, has been a big part of city living. I think that same disconnection exists between us and our environment. You mentioned cities having natural spaces, and I think that gives us an opportunity to segue into this concept you have of replenish and sort of, I'll let you explain it better than me, but I wanted to at least set the stage for it because I think that's a good way to kind of make a connection between this idea of sort of city macro work, which has obviously design elements to it, but is people focused, but all of this exists in the concept of the natural world that we live in. And so that is a backdrop. Kind of walk us through a little bit about how you came up with Replenish, what it means to you and your work. A lot of it, as I've read through some things and I watched some stuff online, you know, TEDx type stuff. And, I don't know if this is part of how you think about it, but I come back to like the work of like someone like Buckminster Fuller and kind of where he was thinking and going so many years ago, 50 plus years ago. So, I've gone on, kind of give us an idea of where you are in that space with Replenish specifically.
I'm just going to let it out. You ready for it?
I'm ready.
All right. So
wait, hold up.
Up.
Wait.
Deep breath.
Okay.
Go.
So Replenish began because I wanted something that was really bugging me. And that was that we weren't really living in harmony with nature. And yet there's this massive concept of success and GDP and the measure of success being actually just the expenditure with no consequences to the environment. And so it really got me thinking, what do we need to do if we want to build the cities of tomorrow to be able to do today? So it's a future present. And I thought living in harmony with nature requires that we don't just match, you know, our CO2 footprint with the exact amount of sequestration, but actually that ain't going to help anybody. The world is the earth itself. It's at such a point of devastation that there's no matching it anymore. We need to go way beyond that. We need to have a positive impact rather than just meeting it. And so that positive impact determine the kind of incentives to get there. And that getting there is where replenish comes in. The positive reinforcement of behaviors that allow people to consume and act in harmony with nature. And it's that giving back more than you take as a philosophy at the basis of the economy that has been missing for me. The way that we consume is an investment. Every time we buy something, it's an investment in that city, in a company, in, you know, every time I buy a donut from the guy down the street, it's going to long term have that incremental value that is provided back into the city. And so that sort of large systemic thinking requires that we think in terms of the large body and the impact that we have locally to that global system. So something that got me going here was that you can design systems that can determine my behavior because I'm constrained by the technology that is provided to me. So these smart cities that are designed are largely designed technologically so that it constrains my behavior. I can't open that window because I'm on the 30th floor of a building. And so the building will only operate because it has a closed loop system. And now by opening the window, I'm going to break the system and allow humidity to come into the building and ruin the experience, I'm sure, for the rest of the building. But what about my relationship with the outside world? What about my relationship as a human being in nature? I am nature. Probably the only programming language that translates through absolutely everything is DNA, mm-hmm. right? The DNA of everything and its energy and matter. And so that relationship that requires that cultivation is sort of lost. It's almost as if because this is a table or some sort of metal instrument or concrete block, that it's not nature, and that there is this sort of constrained behavior of what nature is, even within the city, of a square box called a park, to the extent that my relationship with nature is confined to a square block and that there is no diversity, biodiversity in there, shocks me, because our relationship with the outside is almost like the relationship between us and concrete rather than us and nature. And I want to bring that nature back in because I feel that we are nature. And to segregate ourselves from the natural world is probably the strangest thing. And so replenish sort of starts with this, some of these thoughts of how to give back more than you're taking, the positive reinforcement of these behaviors. What kind of behavior do we need to have in order for those large cultural changes to occur, that lifestyle change that we want to see? And so it really got me thinking in terms of even the business canvas, which is used as a basis for most startups, thinking about these questions once you built the business out, and thinking as an afterthought, let's put a little CSR department together to, right. you know, to put something towards the environment. No. You've got to have that at the beginning. So something that I'm working on right now is the Replenish Business Canvas, which is where you're thinking about these questions at the beginning, at the ideation stage, and you're implementing all of that into the design of the product so that there is no waste. There is no negative impact on the environment. When it comes to the incentivization of our behaviors, it is that you naturally want to live in harmony with nature, that it's not an afterthought. It is ingrained in you to think like that. And that's where, when it comes to the design of these physical spaces, the room that you're in, the city that you're in, it creates the behavior. If you are segregated from nature, you're going to continue to feel that there is something missing in your life, because nature replenishes you naturally. It restores you, sometimes grounds you. And so to have that integrated into our lifestyle is something that I think is very important. Now, the way that it translates is an economic system that allows for that right at the beginning. And this is where businesses can come in. It's a sort of, maybe like a balancing of the act of giving and taking as well. I'd also translate replenish as a sort of a consciousness. It's a global consciousness that just because I'm doing something here, I remember this one conversation I had with a girl where she said, "What does it matter to me? Why should I care?" And it just stopped me. And I thought, you're right. Why should you care? If I go home, I'm probably going to find that 90% of the things that are inside your home don't come from England. They come from India. They come from China. They came from Japan. They came from somewhere else. But your association is so local that you don't think globally. You don't think that this is a unit. You don't think that the air leaving your body is the in-breath of somebody else. You don't think that because you're so individual that you have no association to anything that leaves your body. Where is the end of your body? That which is my hand, the heat that comes out of that dissipates into the environment outside of my hand. The energy, bioelectric force that enters the atmosphere out of my body. Isn't that part of nature too? That environment that is created outside of my body is still me. That heat came from me. And yet the outside is also the inside. And so there's this sort of universal, I suppose, the universe as a unit, the world as a home that we often forget. It's just because we pollute something here that we don't think that that is transboundary. There is no line that goes across the sky that says that this is US turf. It might be for anybody of the aviation industry, but pollution doesn't stop there and say that I'm not going to go into England.
I have a follow up, and when you're working with businesses or policymakers, you're injecting a lot more into this conversation than just sort of science, policy formulation, economics, and even like quote unquote alternative economics. When you start talking about people's viewpoints and people's experience in the world, and even a word like consciousness, is there a kind of added layer of challenge in terms of conveying that viewpoint in this sort of bundle that you're bringing for these kind of changes that we need?
I was sitting with the deputy mayor of Panama. I had 5 hours in Panama City, and I went to see the deputy mayor. We sat down, we spoke for an hour. We brainstormed about the different ideas that there are in the city that she could implement. And actually, I realized that there's something that is often missing in these policymakers, and that is this generalist think, this systemic understanding that people become so specialized that they fail to see outside of the box or inside of the box or where the box even lies. And I think that's where people like myself who cross disciplines end up looking, because we're not part of a system that isn't in some way part of another system. And so that sort of allows us to take this sort of kind of like a zoom out and see the whole thing as almost like this large puzzle and how these bits come together and interconnect. And I think with, you know, policymakers, for example, or businesses have a very specific viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And those people who can bridge those viewpoints are gold dust, because they can really understand that this could have an implication on that, that could have an implication on this. And I think I really urge people who are interested in this to really take on different elements and be open to the discomfort of talking about these things that aren't naturally in their field, because as they do this, the dialogue opens and allows them to be more creative. It allows them to feel and understand something that may make them feel as if they don't know what.
And I feel like
this
you're also asking
is.
Them to be more empathetic as well.
It really, and what is empathy?
Yeah.
You know, in this specific area, empathy is a discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
It is a discomfort. And I think it is the allowance of that discomfort provides the space for that dialogue. I mean, many people who speak with me may not understand where I'm coming from. But as a coach myself, and having been coached myself, the whole array of thinking that I've done, I cannot project that on somebody else. I have to meet them where they are. and then show them the steps that I've taken to get to the thinking that I am at. Not to say that I am right or wrong, but just to kind of allow them the space to take those steps. I think this is where we often stop even having a conversation with people, because we automatically judge that just because somebody doesn't know this field, that they're stupid. They're not. They just haven't been on your journey.
Right.
I couldn't think of a better place to end than that.
That's a beautiful place.
Being on each other's, understanding each other's journey and finding some common spaces that came up a lot in this conversation. We could have gone on forever, but unfortunately I'm getting the stink eye, so I know we can't.
But this will be the first of many conversations with you, I'm sure.
Definitely. Thank
really,
you for
really
joining
appreciate
us.
And there's links to the show description for all the different ways that people could find you. Thank you.